We're preparing our hearts for the Lord, and we're offering up worship to our God, and we sing a song like Oceans. And we make statements like, Spirit, lead me where my faith is without borders. Let me walk upon the waters wherever you would call me. Or take me deeper than my feet would ever wander. My faith would be made stronger. This is a prayer. This is a plea. What are we praying for? And do we mean it in this? We're recognizing, you know, I'm in this situation. I want to know you more, God. I want to be more intimate with you. I want to have a greater faith, Lord. And I recognize that I need your help. I need your involvement because the fact of the matter is, I don't want to do it. It's not comfortable. It's not fun. You'll hear sometimes someone will make the statement, you know, be careful what you pray for. You just might get it. You know, if you're going to pray for patience, you better be ready because the Lord is going to bring things into your life to give you patience. The only way to get patience is through endurance, through tribulation. So be careful. You better be ready. And there's almost this thought that's inherent in that wait until you're already ready to experience that. Then you should ask God. If you're not there yet, don't make that prayer. You need to be careful when you're praying to God. That's foolishness. Because the point of the matter is, we're not there. None of us are there yet. We will one day be glorified, but in this present life, the Lord's working on us. And it is our joy and privilege that we can pray to God and say, God, please, I recognize that what I want is to be the person you want me to be presently. I want to represent you well, but I need your help in that. And I want a greater faith, God. I recognize sometimes I doubt. Please, I want a stronger faith. Help me. Or I recognize I have problems with temper. Give me patience. Give me endurance. Give me character. Something severely lacking in our present day. Character. When a man stands for something or a woman stands for something. But these things are built. Paul, we spoke of it last week in Romans chapter 5. He says, we exult in our tribulations, these difficulties, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance. Perseverance brings about proven character, and proven character, hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us. While we were helpless, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. He is our hope, this resurrection. But we are learning. We are growing as believers. We'll find the results of God's love and His discipline through the answering of prayer, even today in our text with David. It's a matter of perspective, isn't it? It's a matter of perspective. You're going through a situation. How are you viewing the situation? This isn't positive thinking. It's correct thinking. If I know, as a Christian, I'm going to suffer, hey, my Lord suffered, why in the world would I be any different? If I know that the Lord is going to use things in my life to give me character, to increase my faith, increase my hope, what is my perspective towards these things? Is my mind set on things above, and am I understanding that my Father who cares about me is working in and through that? We're going to watch David's perspective today, because the chickens, they're coming to roost for David. Absalom, his treacherous, murderous son, has orchestrated a coup. David should have judged him as the king of Israel, the leader, the representative of Israel. He should have judged his son. He didn't. He allowed him to grow up and go in his own way. He facilitated him. And ultimately, Absalom has rebelled against him. And where we left our story last week, David is having to flee Jerusalem. We've been going along for I don't know how many books so far. We're this far into the Bible, and it's taken that long, this maybe just about 2,000 years, it's taken a good bit of history to get God's kingdom set up, where He has His people in His land being represented by His anointed king, and almost as soon as it pops up, now the kings, we're going in the opposite direction. We're going backwards in the story. What's happening? David's having to flee. Now, we're going to pick up in chapter 15 today towards the end. David is climbing the Mount of Olives on his flight from Jerusalem. Last time we noticed, he came across a couple characters on his way out that were somewhat of an encouragement to him. He came across a Gentile that kind of joined his side along with his armies. He came across the priests who were showing their support of David. But now, as David is coming towards the ascent, he's climbing the Mount of Olives. This is directly across from Jerusalem. He's going to receive some bad news, and it's going to send him to his knees. It's going to send him to prayer, because he's got big trouble. And we're going to look at really chapters 15 through 19 in light of this prayer and how this prayer determines the outcome of David's story in this section. So I want to look at it in three sections. We're going to look at David's petition. We're going to look at God's answer to David's petition. And then we're going to look at David's reception of God's answer. So let's begin with his petition. We will find it in verses 30 and 31 of chapter 15. So follow along with me in chapter 15, verse 30. As David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went, his head was covered and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him, each covered his head and went up weeping as they went. Now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. Word gets back to David that Ahithophel is following his son Absalom, who has led this coup. Now, you may remember last week when we discussed who Ahithophel was. He's one of David's advisors. He's one of his counselors. He is a brilliant man. In fact, chapter 16 told us that his advice, his wisdom, the counsel that he gave, is regarded by David and regarded by Absalom as though it was the word of the Lord. This is a prophet-level individual, okay? When he says something, you do it. Because it's right. It's as sure as the word of the Lord. When a brilliant individual like this joins your enemy, you've got problems. And we notice with Ahithophel, we're trying to say, who is this guy? Tell me a little bit about him. We know that he's the father of one of David's mighty men. So he's been with David for a while. He's well acquainted with war. He's a strategist. And beyond that, he's the grandfather of Bathsheba. So he has an axe to grind. David has defiled his granddaughter and he's killed his grandson-in-law. He's got an axe to grind with David. So when your greatest military strategist defects, he joins the enemy. This spells trouble for you. And it's interesting that David does not petition the Lord about his son, Absalom. Absalom apparently is not as much of a threat to David's life. He's not really worried about his son. After all, his son is inexperienced. He's not a warrior. He hasn't been to battle. He doesn't know what he's doing. But Ahithophel's a problem. Ahithophel could cause disaster for David's army, so he's going to go to the Lord in prayer. He's going to pray, and the prayer is, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. And I just want to make a couple of observations about this. First, notice the prayer as it's recorded. It's short and sweet. It's spontaneous. It's in the moment. It is authentic. It's to the point. Lord, I need your help here. He's not waxing eloquent. If you've been watching any of the Judicial Committee and their grilling of FBI Director Comey or of Secretary Clinton in recent events, you'll notice that there's a lot of lawyer jargon going on. And if any of you have had to deal with courts, you've probably noticed that it's next to impossible for us as civilians to kind of engage in a court system and defend ourselves because there's so much lawyer speak. It's this legal jargon and legalese, and I can't even get along with it. And we take a concept that's really small and really short and sweet and spread it out into two or three paragraphs because we got to cover all our bases, right? This is not like that. You do not have to be a theologian who has studied for X amount of years in a seminary over here to speak to God. It is simple. It is short. It is sweet. It is plain speak. In fact, you might remember our Lord says, don't, when you come and pray to me, don't pray like the Gentiles do. They think they're going to get heard by the amount of words that they're saying to me. So they're using all this vain repetition. Don't do that. Just come, speak plain, let your request be made known. And that's what David does. But secondly, notice that his prayer is specific. It's specific. He's not offering some vague, "Oh Lord, I ask that your will may be done in this matter." Whatever that may be. Well, of course God's will is going to be done in the matter. This isn't some vague thing. He is specific. "Lord, this is the problem. Ahithophel is wise. I need you to make him foolish. He is a big problem for me. Can I get some help in this?" I think a lot of times we feel like we have to offer the Lord like a way out in our prayers. Or we don't allow him to say no. Because sometimes, you know, he'll answer you, but it might be no. So if I'm praying for something or for someone, specifically healing. You know, someone's suffering a terrible illness, maybe cancer. You say, "Lord, I'm asking that you would heal this one, but really, your will be done, whatever it may be in the matter." It's like I have to have that added out for God. Sometimes God's answer is no. We recognize that we're all going to be resurrected one day. The death count is one per person. You say, "Well, Jesus was resurrected, but Lazarus died twice, so it kind of evens out, right?" Anyway, so his prayer is specific, his prayer is short, it's to the point. He's asking specifically, make Ahithophel's counsel foolishness, and that's really a tall order. Don't miss it. This is divine intervention. To make Ahithophel, in his situation, give foolish advice in this critical moment when this rebellion is just taken off, is going to take divine intervention. And that's what he's asking for. So as we move forward in this story, we're going to look and observe, what is God's answer? How does God respond to David on this? And pick it up in verse 32. "Now it happened, as David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, that behold, Hushai the Archite met him with his coat torn and dust on his head. And David said to him, 'If you pass over with me, then you'll be a burden to me. But if you return to the city, and you say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in times past, so I will now be your servant,' then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me." Now, what's going on here? Now, I thought David just asked the Lord to make Ahithophel's counsel foolishness. Does David not trust the Lord to answer his prayer? Is he trying to manipulate the situation out of fear that God's answer might be no? So he says, "Lord, please do this, but in case you don't, I'm going to work on this over here." Or is it possible that he sees this as part of God's answer to his prayer? And that he sees a personal responsibility in bringing about the fulfillment of God's answer to his prayer. You guys, I'm sure many of you have heard the story before about the man who was living in an area that was below sea level, and there's a great flood, and the flood started rising. He lived in a one-story house, and as it began to rise above his steps and into his house, some folks came by in a truck and told him, "Hey, you know, this flood's supposed to be pretty bad. Why don't you come with us? We'll help you get out of here." He says, "Don't worry about it. The Lord's going to save me." And praise to God, "Oh Lord, will you save me from this flood that's coming?" Okay, well, the guys drive off. Water continues to rise. He ends up having to flee up to the roof of his house. And a boat comes by and says, "Hey, this flood's still coming. You know, why don't you hop in our boat? We'll help you get out of here." He says, "Don't worry about it. The Lord's going to save me." Water continues to rise. He has to jump up on his chimney. You know, he's about out of space to run. The helicopter comes by and says, "Hey, the flood's still going to rise." He says, "Don't worry about it. The Lord's going to save me." Well, of course, the water rises. The man drowns. And he finds himself in heaven before the Lord. And he says, "Lord, I trusted that you were going to answer my prayer, that you were going to save me. What happened?" The Lord says, "Well, I sent you a truck, a boat, and a helicopter. What more do you want?" So the idea, the question is, should we participate? Is there any participation? Is the only answer to prayer divine intervention to the degree that I don't have to do anything and I'm not expected to do anything? David seems to believe that he has a part to play in this, that God's working in and through people to answer his prayer. This is an incarnational idea, that God is working in and through people in this world. To put this in a context we might understand, if I were to want to do well on a test, I might pray, Lord, please, I need help on this test. Help me to do well on this test. But I yet also have an obligation to study for that test. Or if I were to pray, Lord, please bring my children to know you. Well, I also have an obligation to teach my children about the Lord, do I not? I have an obligation to participate. If I am to pray, oh Lord, give me a good harvest, do I not have an obligation to sow seed? Well, harvest has to come from somewhere. If we as a church are going to pray that we are going to affect this community, that we are going to grow as a body, do we not have an obligation to participate through evangelism? God is working incarnationally. His answer is coming in and through Christ's body, which you are a member of. So when you're sitting at home and you have that inkling, you know, you're like, man, I feel like I should call this person, or this person needs some help, or whatever. The Lord very well may be answering someone's prayer through you. It is an incarnational action. God is working in and through people. So we're not spectators in this. We're gladiators. We are in the thick of this arena that we call life. And God is using you to accomplish His sovereign purposes. Now, when we look at this, if the appearance of Hushai was the answer to David's prayer, when did the Lord begin preparing the answer to David's prayer? I mean, David is about at the summit. He prays. He gets to the summit. Here's Hushai. He's got his coat all torn up, dust on his head. He's coming to meet David. When did the Lord begin preparing the answer to David's prayer? Before he even prayed it. Now, sometimes we have this problem then arise. We say, well, wait a minute now. What purpose does prayer play? If David hadn't prayed, wouldn't Hushai have still been there because God had already sent him, right? God is sovereign. He knows all things. Are we actually affecting and working with Him in the world by our prayers? Is anything really happening, or is it just some kind of sleight of hand? Well, I would say a couple things just to briefly touch on a much larger question. But once I would at least think that it's important to note that Jesus the God-man prayed. And if Jesus the God-man thought that it was necessary or beneficial to pray, I can at least take it on faith that I probably ought to pray as well. Okay, if God in the flesh is appealing to the Father, at least I, who am not God, ought to at least appeal to the Trinity as well. Secondly, I would at least notice that although God may have ordained and been orchestrating the answer to this prayer before it was prayed, He still didn't have it come to pass until after David prayed. Did He? The sovereign God who knows all things, He could have set it up to where it could have appeared any time. He didn't. He set it up to where it appeared after David prayed. He was preparing His way ahead of time. It is an incarnational both and. Just as we look at Christ and say, how can Christ, the God-man, inform our theology and inform how we behave as the church, as people, as representatives, as believers? This is one of those things. We got to recognize that it is not just a God doing His thing over here and me doing my thing over here. You are, contrary to what some of the political statements recently made, you are all created in the image of God. You bear the likeness of God. You are God's representatives, which means image. David and I were talking about this morning. You are the physical representation of God on earth. Like an idol is a physical representation. You know, I think of Baal or something, so I carved this like a wooden statue. Now it's dead. It can't do anything. That doesn't represent God. God has made living creatures to represent Him physically on this physical world. And He's put His Son in one of those creatures to represent Him. But secondly, we're made in His likeness. That is, we are to represent His character, His desires, His will on this earth. It is incarnational. That is how God is accomplishing His will. He's not just doing magic. Like, okay, everything is just a glitz from above, a magic. He wants to work through you. And that's what we see here. That's what David obviously believes. Now, look at verse 37. So David sends his friend, Hushai. He goes into the city. He comes to Absalom in Jerusalem. Now, we're going to skip halfway into chapter 16. Basically, David's going to come across a couple other fellows, and all of it's bad news. The first is Ziba. You might remember Ziba. He was the servant put in charge of Mephibosheth. David showed sacrificial mercy, God's love, to Jonathan's son, Saul's descendant, Mephibosheth. Ziba comes, he refreshes David, and he says, guess what? Mephibosheth has betrayed you. He's betrayed you. This is a huge knock on David. Now, it's not true. We'll find out later. But nonetheless, Ziba is hedging his bets that Absalom's rebellion will fail, and he's trying to curry favor with David. After that, he's going to come across an individual named Shimei. And Shimei is a Benjamite. He's from the house of Saul. And he just follows David and his entourage, and he curses him, and he throws rocks at him as David is forced to flee Jerusalem. And David's men want to go and cut his head off because he's cursing God's anointed. He says, let him go. He has perspective in the matter. David recognizes this may be the Lord's discipline. The Lord may have sent him to curse me. And if that pleases the Lord, let him go. And he goes along with it. We come to Hushai. Hushai finally makes it to Absalom. He manages to talk his way into Absalom's court. Absalom says, I thought you were my dad's friend. What are you doing here? He's like, look, I'm whoever's friend is the leader of Israel. Okay, whoever the people choose, whoever's ruling on God's throne in Jerusalem, I'm that guy's friend. Okay, and I want to represent you as well. He says, okay, come on. And he begins receiving advice. And the first advice he receives is, of course, from who? Ahithophel, right? The man with an axe to grind. The man whose granddaughter was assaulted by David. And his first piece of advice we find at the end of chapter 16. He tells Absalom, go into your father's concubines. These are the 10 he left behind to keep house. And all Israel will hear that you've made yourself odious to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof. Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. This is fulfilling a prophecy. God already told him he was going to do it, but this is it coming true in history. So Ahithophel is taking revenge on David tenfold. You did it to Bathsheba. Now your son's going to do it to your wives before everybody. But he's not going to stop there, though. He wants to keep going. So look at chapter 17 as you start. Ahithophel goes on. We've done this. Great. Here's the next thing you need to do. Here's his counsel. Ahithophel says to Absalom, please, let me choose 12,000 men that I may arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he's weary and exhausted and terrify him, so that all the people who are with him will flee. Then I will strike down the king alone, and I will bring back all the people to you. The return of everyone depends on the man you seek, and all the people will be at peace. So the plan pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. He's well acquainted with war. He's been with David. He knows David. He's a strategist. His recommendation, you strike while the iron is hot. Okay, this is like a boxing match. If your opponent is dizzied, you don't take that time to get your endurance back and let him kind of stable himself. You got to strike. You put him down when he's dazed, right? You give it everything you got while the opportunity is there, because that opportunity might not present itself again. And the advice seems good. It's interesting that Ahithophel wants to personally carry out his plan. Now, it may be true that he's the most equipped for the job. Remember, he's been in league with David and his mighty men. Well, David's mighty men left with David. They're not hanging around with Absalom. So Absalom's men, probably less experienced. Probably they're not the valiant men that we read in the end of 2 Samuel. So Ahithophel might be the most equipped. He also might want to carry out vengeance. Not only did you defile Bathsheba, you killed Uriah. And it's coming back on you by my hand. Okay. So the advice he gives, it pleases Absalom. It looks like this is where the story is going until, enter Hushai, the Cushite. David's man on the scene. Verse 5, Absalom said, now call Hushai the Archite, and let us hear what he has to say. What do you think about Ahithophel's plan? Should we follow it? Does it seem good to you? Verse 7, he says, no. This time the advice of Ahithophel, it's not good. You don't want to follow that. And here's why. Let me tell you. You might know this. Your father is a mighty man of war. And he is upset. He's incensed. He's like a bear robbed of his cubs. You've taken Jerusalem from him. He's on fire right now. If you send a small company, if you want to go out and try to capture him, I'm going to tell you one thing. He hasn't laid down with his people to go to sleep. He's in a camp somewhere. He's set up. He's got an ambush waiting on you, and he will descend upon you like a walking Armageddon. He'll wipe out that small group of people. And when he does, your people will be demoralized. All of Israel will be afraid. Just don't do that. He has a different suggestion. Notice it in verse 11. But I counsel that all Israel be surely gathered to you, from Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand is by the sea in abundance, and that you personally go into battle. So we shall come upon him in one of the places where he can be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and of all the men who are with him, not even one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city, and we will drag it into the valley until not even a small stone is found there. He appeals to Absalom. He appeals to his pride, his arrogance. He says, no. What you need to do, we need to amass a big army. Everybody, bring them all here. And you personally go, you as the representative, this way you will get the victory, and the victory will be assured because sheer numbers. We'll just amass the biggest army we got, and we will crush him. And we won't just crush him, we'll crush everybody with him. Verse 14, Absalom and the men of Israel, they accept it. They say, Hushai's advice is better than Ahithophel's. They follow it. And this seals the fate of the war. This answer to David's prayer. Notice what happens. First of all, Ahithophel, verse 23, realizes it. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, he arose, he went to his home, to his city, he set his house in order, and he strangled himself. And thus he died and was buried in the grave of his father. Why does Ahithophel kill himself? Some have said, oh, well, he's just offended. He's offended that his advice was spurned. So he just goes and ends his life. No. No. You might recall in 1945, after World War II, after Japan's unconditional surrender, General MacArthur sends out his orders to arrest the first 40 war criminals. And on that list is Tojo, the general of Japan's army. And he sends his military police to go and to capture Tojo. Of course, Tojo, he can read the tea leaves. He knows what's coming. He has a doctor at his house. And he has the doctor mark with charcoal on his chest where his heart is. And when these military police arrive to serve him, to take him into custody, they hear a muffled shot inside the house. And they go in, and Tojo has shot himself. But the problem is, even though the doctor has marked his heart, he somehow missed. And he's on the ground, he's bleeding, he says, I'm very sorry it's taking me so long to die. And he goes and basically says that he thinks that his people were justified and that he had hoped that he could kill himself, but sometimes even suicides don't work out. They end up taking him, of course. They revive him to health. They even give him dentures. You know, they fix it, or dental work at least. They fix him up really good so they can put him on trial so they can execute. But what's going on? Why does Tojo try to kill himself? Why does Ahithophel kill himself? Because the war is over. You lost. Nothing remains for you but judgment. Nothing remains for Ahithophel at this point but judgment. The rebellion is over. The minute that Absalom decided to personally accompany his army into battle, the war was over. And Ahithophel knows it. He's wise. He knows David. He knows Absalom is inexperienced. He doesn't know a thing about war. You're just going to grab this massive army and you're going to lead it into battle? It's over. So he takes his own life. Why wait for David to come in and to judge me with whatever terrible implement he chooses. He ends his life. Now, David's spies, he also has, not only does he have Hushai, he also has some priests that are helping him out. They come and they inform David ahead of time. They know Absalom's plan. They know he's coming, so David sets up the army. He's ready to go to war. He has three companies: Joab, Joab's brother, and then he has Ittai the Gittite, who popped up. Each one is commander over at least 1,000 men, probably more. He has commanders over thousands and commanders over hundreds. But they don't let David go to battle with him. Why? Because Absalom's only interested in David. Now, David's not there and the people flee. Absalom's not really worried about the people. He wants to just kill David. So David stays out of battle, but you'll notice it. In chapter 19, as they're preparing to go, nonetheless, David is going to charge his leaders right in front of all the army. And he's going to tell them, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. Probably not the best motivational speech to give your men who are heading into battle. Don't fight the enemy commander. Don't kill him. Just be sure you treat him well. It's interesting, you know, before David condemns Uriah, a righteous man, to death, it seems now the pendulum has swung. And he cannot bring himself to judge his son, Absalom, who is guilty multiple times over with death sentences. He can't condemn him to death. David's perspective is askewed, and it's a problem. But nonetheless, the people go out to battle, and God is answering the prayer. How is he answering the prayer? What was David's prayer? "Make the counsel of Ahithophel foolish." So he sends Hushai, who advises that Absalom goes to battle, and notice what happens. Verse 6, chapter 18. The people went out into the field against Israel. Israel is following Absalom at this point. The battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David. The slaughter there that day was great. 20,000 men. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside. And notice it, the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. The forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Now, what's going on here? Obviously, there's divine intervention in this battle, but and if you look at alternate sources of how it's translated, Josephus and some others seem to be inclined to think that some wild beasts and other things had part in this battle, but more than likely, that may have had a part in it, but because of their inexperience, as they're fleeing into the forest is preventing them from getting away. They're getting caught up in thickets. They're getting bottlenecked in. It's not like a flat plain where you can just take off. So they can't flee from David's army. They're getting caught up. They're killing one another, and David's army is able to go in and easily kill them as well. They can't flee. The forest is just devouring them. They lose, and they lose bad. Here's one example of how the forest is devouring them. Notice it in verse 9. "And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. For Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him kept going." So Absalom's run away on his little mule. He's caught. Now, I don't know if his head is just wedged. You might remember early in the story, the author saw it fit to include a little bit about his hair and how thick his hair was. So it may be that his hair is just caught up in this thicket. Either way, he's stuck. A man finds him, recognizes, good grief, there's Absalom. He's stuck in a tree. He goes and tells Joab. Joab says, "Why didn't you strike him down?" And he has to remind Joab, in case you weren't paying attention, David said, "We don't strike his son down." Joab says, "I don't have time to sit here and discuss this with you." And Joab goes, he takes his men. Verse 14, he takes three spears in his hand. He thrusts them through the heart of Absalom while he's yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around, and they struck him and killed him. So they just surround him and they just turn him into a piñata. They take him and they bury him in a pit. And the war is over. Absalom dies, no more rebellion. The trumpet is blown, the rebellion is over. Now we just have to tell David. David's prayer to God has been answered. So Joab sends, and in fact, one thing that's interesting here, I won't labor on it, but one thing you'll notice, there's kind of a narrative going on.
The message is sent, but Joab knows that it's not really, David's not going to receive it well. Because David charged him, don't do this. So he sends a runner, and one of the runners is David's spy that he had been working for. He says, you're not going to go. You're not going to get rewarded for this, so don't worry about it. He wants to go anyway, so you have this long narrative of these two runners who are trying to get to David with the news. And what's interesting is there's more real estate given in the chapter to this delivery of the news than there is to the battle. I mean, the battle's like two verses. So the author seems to think the delivery is much more important than the battle itself. Nonetheless, the delivery, interestingly as well, the word, they're coming to bring good news, and everyone's expecting good news. Like in verse 25, the watchman, when he sees this one coming, he says, if he's by himself, there's good news in his mouth. And they're coming to deliver this. And the word, of course, is euangelion in the Septuagint. It is the gospel. They're bringing the gospel to David, the gospel of his salvation. The gospel is his salvation through the death of his enemy. And David receives it. Verse 31, notice that the Cushite arrives. He's the second one. Let the Lord, the king, receive good news. For the Lord has vindicated you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. And the king asked the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, let the enemies of my lord the king, all who rise up against you for evil, be as that young man. He's dead. And the king is deeply moved. And he goes into his chamber and he weeps. And thus he says as he walks, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would that I have died instead of you. Absalom, my son. Now you may recall his previous responses. David's lost several sons at this point. He lost Amnon. He's lost his son with Bathsheba. How was his response in those situations? As soon as the death was certain, he's over it. He's not going to come to me now. No point in wasting any more tears. I'll go to him, is David's response. Not with Absalom. What's the difference? David seems to be secure in a future for Amnon. He seems to be secure in a future for his child with Bathsheba. They know the Lord. He's not certain about Absalom. He may never see Absalom again. He doesn't know where he is. He's dead. And he had no indication in his life of following the Lord. Now, David's upset. Is it right for David to be upset? We'll find that Joab ultimately rebukes him for it, and he receives it. Why? The people come back. They've offered David salvation. It's turned to mourning. Their victory is turned to mourning because the king is not happy. And Joab's rebuke to David, he finds out, he's incensed. Everyone's going to leave you, David. Notice what he says to him. Verse 5 of chapter 19, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, the lives of your concubines by loving those who hate you and hating those who love you. Your perspective is skewed, David. Get it together. For you've shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, that you would be pleased. The word there is that it would be right in your eyes. Your perspective's wrong, David. Now arise, go and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not a man will pass the night with you. This will be worse for you than all the evil that's come upon you from your youth until now. And David, of course, accepts this wise counsel from Joab. How bad is it? If that's going to be like being rebuked by Donald Trump. You got this horrible, morally askew character coming to you, and he says, what are you doing? Your perspective is all whack, and he's right. Man, that cuts deep. But David accepts it. Now, what can we gain from this passage today? What can I gain from this? I mean, there's certainly a lot going on here, and we've just touched one thing, mainly we've been focusing on this prayer that kind of turned the tides of the battle. But I think one thing we should certainly take away is that in our times of distress, it doesn't matter what you're going through, the devil does not have the ability to cut your supply lines to God. He doesn't. That supply line of prayer cannot be hindered by the devil. God will always be there to hear you. Now, the problem comes down to, our perspective in this matter. What is our perspective in regards to our request? You might remember James spoke on this. He says, you guys ask, but you don't receive because you ask to benefit your own pleasures. You're asking with the wrong motives. That's James 4:3. He says you need to adjust your perspective. You need to make your concerns the same concerns as God's concerns. Then you'll receive. But as it stands, you're just looking to benefit yourself. Secondly, I'd say we need to adjust our perspective and our participation with prayer. And our concept of prayer. I'm not just an unwilling outside individual waiting for God to do everything for me. I'm participating in this. I am behaving as though I already have the answer. God, I'm asking you for this, and I'm going to work towards doing everything I can in my responsibility to see that it takes place. Because God is working incarnationally. He's working in this world. Think of Paul in 1 Corinthians 15. He's talking about the apostles and how he's the least of the apostles. But he's saying, look, I labored more than all of them though. But not I, yet the Spirit of God that works within me. It is incarnational. It's a both and. God is going before you as you go about your tasks. Participation. Lastly, I would say we need to adjust our perspective and our reflection. When I am looking back and reflecting on the answer to God's prayer. This can't be the answer to God's prayer because I'm suffering. Suffering cannot be a positive thing for the Christian. Only if it puts food on my table or money in my pocket or gives me pleasure. That's a blessing. No, the Lord has greater plans for you. That you would grow in your character and your faith. That you'd be able to fully represent Him in this life. And sometimes that comes through difficulties. How is it that David is able to bear his situation? He's cast out of his kingdom. He's losing his kids. His kids are raping each other. His sons are dying. His son's trying to kill him. How does David bear this sorrow? It is his perspective. He recognizes God's discipline in his life. He recognizes God is working. He hasn't abandoned him. He has a promise from God. He's looking for a future seed of his that will be set on the throne. He has hope in the resurrection in God's kingdom because of the hope that David has, which is the same hope that you have. You can suffer in this life. You have the freedom to die because you'll be resurrected. You can die for your faith. You have eternity to live in the kingdom. God shows that His Son, Jesus, overcomes the Gentile powers. Rome, they can't even keep His dead body in a tomb. They got nothing. The most that Satan and the most that the world can do to you is kill you. That's their Ace of Spades. What happens when the Ace of Spades doesn't work? You can't be touched. You will be resurrected. Viktor Frankl, a Jewish psychologist who went through the Holocaust, shared an observation in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. It is an observation somewhat similar to what Nietzsche was saying. He says, those who have a why to live can bear almost any how. These are people he's observing in the Holocaust, in these concentration camps. Some are surviving better than others. What makes the difference? Why is this one going to die and this one not going to die? Has nothing to do with their physical prowess or what they're eating. It has to do with whether they had meaning in their life. They found meaning in their suffering, which is why he will go on to say, in some ways, suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment that it finds meaning. Suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment it finds meaning. Now, of course, this comes from a man who is an atheist existentialist. That means he thinks that you give yourself meaning in this life. Okay, I am making myself. Now, ultimately, that has no power. Because in the end, you die. It's meaningless. Everything you do is meaningless. So you can pretend to have meaning, but you still have that truth lurking in the back of your mind your entire life. This is all for nothing. No one will remember me. In fact, there'll come a time that people don't even exist. It's a waste of time. But not for the Christian. Your suffering does have meaning. It has eternal value. This momentary light affliction is producing in us an eternal weight of glory, according to Paul. You have meaning in your suffering.